Poverty is the type of complex problem that requires a multi-pronged approach. Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America, is a new public media reporting initiative to provide a deeper understanding of poverty. In poverty-stricken areas, access to affordable and healthy food is a major issue, and it's related to other issues like diabetes and obesity. Jamie Holding Eagle is in a public health master's program at North Dakota State University, and she is particularly interested in food for health. Holding Eagle wants to grow ancestral foods and educate people who didn't grow up eating traditional foods about ways to prepare it. She visited with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg.
Jamie, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
What started your interest in ancestral food?
I've had an interest in health for a long time. When I was an undergrad, I was in the program called Health and Medical Sciences, and so I really liked the idea of healthcare. But once I got to the end of my program, I'd gone to a talk by Winona LaDuke, and she talked about the power and the history behind traditional foods that people had been eating, and that kind of prompted me to do my own research. So I started looking at my own family, and my great-great-grandmother had been what was called a seed keeper, a Mandan seed keeper, a seed priest.
And what is that?
They would call the corn spirits back from the south, and they would do certain types of seed blessings. My family's from Fort Berthold. We had been agriculturalists for a long time up until the building of the Garrison Dam. Took out a lot of our farmland, and that kind of caused another major shift in our agriculture.
You became a farmer, sort of. A gardener, I guess, is maybe the more correct word. How did you go from growing up in Fargo to having an interest in this?
I was also in a women's studies program, and so we also talked a lot about marginalization of health. It's one thing to say that people should be eating better. You look at all the other factors that go into it. Do you have access to it? Do you have the time to cook? Do you have stable housing? All these other factors tie into it.
So if you're going to tell someone you should eat some quinoa or you should eat some vegetables or something like that, and then like you take a bag of quinoa and you're like, what
do you do with it? Okay, so in North Dakota right now, the average age of death for a white person is 74 years, and the average age of death for a Native person is 54 years. And so that is happening right now in North Dakota. Globally, diabetes is on the rise, and it happens here in North Dakota. So the diabetes rate for white folks in North Dakota is about 7%, and for Native folks, it's about 13%. So it's almost twice as high. However, the death rate is actually six times higher. These are what's happening right now in North Dakota. This isn't, some long ago past. I mean, it's happening right now.
What's behind that? I'm sure it's a multi-part answer, but some of the basic things that have contributed to those very high rates of getting diabetes and then the much higher rate of actually dying from diabetes.
Over the last 50 years, we've seen a major shift for everybody. Most people's food now is a lot more processed than it ever has been. So if you're looking at a Native population or like a rural population, if your only source of groceries would be the local convenience store, you really don't have a lot of options.
And in some cases, too, it was part of the European takeover of this country and the government that came in and didn't allow Native people to eat ancestral food anymore and instead gave low nutritional quality food, high calorie food.
So if you look at our traditional farming practices and traditional hunting practices and food preparation, you burn a lot of calories when you're hunting. You burn a lot of calories when you're grinding corn. So for generations, that was how communities were set up. And in fact, among the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, the women were the farmers. So for generations, that had been the way the community was set up, and then the men did the hunting. When allotments came along, there was a big shift where now for the settlers, the men were the farmers and the women stayed at home. And so that was pushed among the Native communities that these roles should be switched. And that doesn't happen very easily. It does cause a disruption in a community. If someone were to come in and switch the roles, how easy do you adjust to that? Also, there had been a campaign of eliminating the buffalo. So there were millions killed around the late 1800s. There were photos of these mountains, of these bison bones. And that was one of our main sources of protein, and it was also a major component of life. We utilized all parts of it.
What you are doing now is trying to cultivate sort of a return to ancestral eating, and that comes both with planting traditional foods mm-hmm. and also teaching how to eat them. Can you kind of explain what it is that you do?
So now I'm in Master's of Public Health program. And so when we look at these huge rates, obviously, if somebody were just to go on a diet of lettuce and lentil beans, they would, you know, people would do well. But that's not really a sustainable change. That's not really the kind of change that you can make. And in fact, with diabetes, there's been a high correlation with depression. If someone has been diagnosed with it, what are the next steps that you could do with it? So in a Native community, or for any sort of community, it seems like the logical step would be like a medication. A different kind of approach would be, before we even gets to that point, if you can start integrating more traditional foods. If you went to your grandparents and you gave them something that they had never heard of, it's not going to be very successful. I mean, if you went to your grandparents and said, here's a bag of kale and, you know, something they weren't familiar with, maybe they'll try it. But that's not really a sustainable life change. And that's not something that's going to stick. Instead, okay, look at the foods that they grew up with. You know, what were they familiar with? What can you ask them about that? And that is really what will create a longer change. You know, if you can tie a connection to, remember, we used to have these stories, we had these songs, we had these kind of seeds that we used. That's how really how you build a culture. You have a connection there to health, a connection to culture. You know, you can be celebrating with your community, with your family, as opposed to if you're just taking medication, you don't really have like a metformin party. There's no real culture around it.
Sure. You're managing a disease after the fact versus preventing one.
There are so many things that go along with foods, right? There are songs and there are words and language and there are certain types of recipes and teachings that went along with it. And these are really important, you know, and I would encourage anybody to always ask their grandparents, you know, what did you grow? What did your neighbors grow?
What kinds of songs?
Songs that you would sing at different parts of the year. For instance, the corn song where you'd be singing to call them back from the south. You know, the growing season was obviously very short, and so some of our teachings were that the corn spirits went south when it was cold, and then they'd be summoned back when it was the right time.
And that would have been something that in particular your great-great-grandmother would have done, or was this completely open to everyone?
That would have been one of her roles, would be to help summon these corn spirits back. But also, we do a disservice when we look at these as just folk traditions, you know, something that somebody did. I mean, really, if you think about it, the women up here were able to take a crop that took 4 months in tropical weather and get it to grow up here in 3 months with these crazy plains and, you know, winds and things like that. You know, that really took a lot of skill there. Corn was very successful and it successfully fed communities for generations.
Before this interview, you and I met for coffee just to kind of talk some things over. And we were talking about a pilot project that's going on near us, and it's called Little Free Gardens. And the basic concept is garden beds were provided for free and that people were supposed to plant in them, and then you could come along and eat them, sort of like the Liberty Gardens, you know, following World War II, where food was just accessible. And I thought it was adorable. I am from a majority population when it comes to power and entitlement. I didn't grow up with the same background, the same ancestral history of what's happened to my people. And you, well, you call it a Band-Aid approach. What is the better alternative?
So when we look at food systems, I mean, you know, our food comes from 3,000 miles away. You know, there are so many precarious elements right now. I mean, a grocery store has 3 days worth of food. When we look at food drives, people really mean well. When we look at something like a food pantry, that doesn't actually solve any sort of issues that are going on. I mean, people should be able to be working and afford food for their families. And unfortunately, we don't see that. It doesn't fill in as much. It's like it's patching it up, but that's not the long-term approach.
That goes back to the education piece that you are trying to do.
We have a long ways to go to really learn this stuff. And I don't think that it's impossible. You know, I absolutely believe that we can learn how to grow more of our food. But we're in a location, you know, where we do just have to be mindful of it. You know, we need to think about it ourselves. Should we really be getting avocados 12 months out of the year? I think they're great. But what is the impact on that?
What do you mean by that?
Getting an avocado from further south and it's nice for us, but are we then making it artificially high for people who actually were traditionally eating it?
A lot of this Chasing the Dream project is specifically focused on poverty in the sense that there are multiple problems that create poverty, that keep people in poverty, and there are multiple possible solutions. And obviously, you deal mostly with food. How is a poor diet related to poverty, and how is a good diet a possible solution for escaping poverty?
There are 8 to 10 fast food restaurants in mine that are closer, and there's one grocery store. So if you're tired, you know, if it's been a long day, you're going to probably opt for the fast food more. There are very few communities where you can work full-time at minimum wage and actually be able to afford anything. And so if you've been working all day, it's not always the easiest thing to go and cook and that kind of stuff. There are several neighborhoods in our communities that actually don't even have a grocery store within a mile or two. You know, if you look at Jefferson or Madison, there isn't one. In each of those, one has a liquor store close to it and the other has a convenience store close to it. Those aren't solutions there. However, we can't always just say that more stores is a solution. I mean, you have to be able to have money to go there. Let's see, if you do have money, is it culturally appropriate food? Kind of going back to my grandparents' thing, if all they had was kale or quinoa, my grandparents have never seen it before, it's probably not going to stick. Food has to be able to be appealing and has to be, you know, you have to be able to want to eat it. Can you get access to it? Do you have stable housing? Do you have the utensils to do so? Can you actually cook something in your house? Do you have all the things for it? You know, like a lot of people in homeless shelters actually have jobs. So their diet may not end up being the best if you don't actually have the facilities with which to cook yourself.
So you end up eating a lot of takeout food, a lot of processed food, which in turn is leading to the chronic health conditions, which in turn is leading to more doctor bills, potentially less productive at work, and thereby potentially decreasing your overall wage earning. I mean, it's like a circular problem where one just feeds into the next, into the next, into the next.
One of the first things that really got me interested in differences in food access was I was riding my bike, and I was coming around a corner, and there's a restaurant, and they had a sign in front of it that said Farmer's Market Salad, $14. And right across the street was a takeout pizza that was $10. So if you only have a certain amount of money, I mean, which one of those are you going to go for?
Pizza can feed 2 or 3 people.
Yeah, you can go further on that than you could with the farmer's market salad. And that really shouldn't be how it is. You know, we really shouldn't end up in that situation.
I was talking to my boss, Bill Thomas, and he is reading a book that is the history of the United States told from an indigenous point of view. And we were both talking about how when we were in school and we're both white, we were sort of led to believe that when Europeans arrived in what's now the United States, it was not very settled. It was mostly wild. The people who lived here were savages, and that we had to kill or be killed, essentially. And this book is saying, no, that's not at all correct. It was largely an agrarian society. A lot of people who were farmers, there were well-established cities the same size as London at the time. There were well-established trade routes. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem with telling these stories is that when only a certain group of people is in power, only a certain group of people is telling that story. And me growing up, I mean, I didn't even, I guess, really realize the racist tinge to that history lesson. How do we get the right voices involved in rewriting this narrative?
I think that's a pretty big question there. Well, definitely, you know, if we had healthy food up until the 1940s, there were only 21 diagnosed cases of diabetes among, I believe it were the Navajo. And now up to half of the tribe has it. And these are causing real problems in our communities. But how do you go about changing that message? God, I don't know. I feel like that's what I'm trying to do, like, all the time.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. I don't normally like to do this, but I want to talk about your looks, because you have a lip piercing, you're wearing kind of cool, funky jewelry, you've got a couple tattoos, you've got some color in your hair. You look like a very approachable person. Why is that important?
So when I was a kid, like, I was not, you know, I was not a farming kid. I grew up in the city. I was afraid of bugs. I didn't like vegetables. I mean, I just was like a nerdy kid. I didn't like going outside. But when I got back into it as an adult, you know, I saw how important it was, and I wanted to get my daughters involved in it as well. But if you talk to people about it, if you talk to people my age and, you know, on either side of it, actually, people will always say, oh, I have a black thumb. Oh, I can't grow anything. And when we say that, we kind of begin to reinforce that, we couldn't grow anything. So I encourage people to just try stuff. I try to make it look fun, try to make it look cool. I mean, it is. There's so much things that you could, there's so many different things that you can do with it. There's so much culture and language and beauty around food. We get afraid of failure. We get afraid of trying things that there's no way this will ever work out. I didn't grow up on a farm and I didn't have this. Well, we all learn skills. I mean, there are urban agriculture. There's a seed company in New York City that is breeding seeds that are optimized for growing on rooftops. Really cool innovations happening, and I think that we can all be a part of it. You know, you don't have to worry about not having this botanist background. You know, for me, I think the most important things was my women's studies degree, because it showed me how much we have to be aware of all the circumstances involved in things. That when I looked at public health, it wasn't just eat better, it's what are all the circumstances that are impacting that.
So a lot of your gardening work started with focusing on getting this food reintroduced to a native population, and now it is working with getting healthy food access to new Americans. Why is that important to you?
The kind of food that people eat will have an impact on their health. It's also been shown is that culturally appropriate food makes a huge difference. Most native people are lactose intolerant. I mean, we didn't start eating dairy until about 100 years ago. The whole food pyramid thing doesn't quite work out for us when a big part of it is, you know, expected to drink milk all day. And so if you really want people to be healthy, having that food that they understand makes a difference. Among the Maori of New Zealand, they show similarly high rates of diabetes and health impacts that we see up in North America among our natives. Among poor people in Mexico, there are also high rates of diabetes and obesity. So wherever we've had American food, we've basically also brought our bad health. One thing I wanted to say was that while it looks like a trend, the growth in food and kind of the awareness of it, it's really not. I mean, it's really just a return to tradition, you know, and I never want to devalue what other people have done. I really want to encourage people to look at their communities and just to ask their grandparents and to ask the people around them what they grew. And there's a lot of things that we can be learning.
Jamie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative, including Prairie Public, led by WNET. Major funding is provided by the JPB Foundation, with additional funding from the Ford Foundation and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.